Good evening, you all. I'm K2 Romeo India Whiskey. My name is Dick. At this time, as we've done for the last 29 and a half years, each Sunday evening, a group of enthusiastic amateur radio operators, and sometimes non-amateur radio operators, get together, discuss their favorite subject. Ham radio in general, wireless techniques. We really want to know, every one of us wants to know a little bit more about how to make those antennas work better, how to make that feed line work better, why does it act that way, why does my bird want me to read that way, what's really going on inside of my transmitter or my receiver, how to fix it, what is radio propagation like. There's 26 different kinds of ham radio. The one you're listening to right now, 2-meter FM repeater type ham radio, is one of the 26 kinds. And if for some reason it doesn't please you, and there's repeaters on 6 meters, 10 meters, 1296, 432, 2 gigs, and so on. So there's even subsets of many other kinds of ham radio just within that one kind of the 26 kinds. Let me drop. So if the one you're using right now doesn't please you, before you give up this extremely educational and very educational hobby, here we go. A real fun hobby, and it's very educational. Before you give it up, try one of the other 25 kinds, is what I'm saying. With the great amount of help of John, KC2WGB, who's taken over the process of what Mel used to do. Mel's mailbag, K2KEY, was with me for at least 6 years, and we really miss the fact that he's now a silent key. And so when it comes to people who do not yet have a ham radio license and can't sign in directly with this particular repeater, stand by a second. Oh, yeah, I got that button pressed in. I was worried about whether or not that button is pressed in. As you can see, the speech processor, if I don't turn it on this rig, it sounds pretty muffled. A new amateur that doesn't yet have his license and can't get on this particular net, because what we do, we worry about them. What we do is to provide a live give-and-take communication as to what a person would like to know. We have not promised, in general, a written consulting service free of charge. John and I are not promising that. We do promise to do our best. Of the people who sign in during the first hour, we try to give them at least a brief answer during the first hour. In theory, a person never has to wait longer than an hour to get an answer to their particular question. On top of that, for people who are unable to last the whole 4 hours the technet usually lasts. We start at 8 in the morning. Hey, here we go. 8 at night. We last until midnight on most technets. That's 4 solid hours. And for those who can't stay up that late, what a few of the guys do is go to the website where it's all recorded. A very enthusiastic guy named Mike Perry, KC2NJI, has for over 6 years recorded every one of the technets and documented many of them. So within a couple of days of the actual technet, you go to Mike's website, which is www.amateurradio.tangovictor. You go there and you can download the audio of all of the technets for the last 6 years. So that's probably 1,500 hours worth. The total technet, when you add up all of the hours of the technet, it's approximately the identical number of hours that Johnny Carson has spent on The Tonight Show in 30 years. Years of Tonight Shows. The total number of hours of TechNet and the total number of hours of Johnny Carson are almost the same. That kind of amazes me that a particular group of guys will do that, if you know what I mean. Alrighty, a person signs out. There were some interesting things that occurred today, and we'll be discussing those a little bit later, after the first hour. There was a flea market at the Hall of Science. There was the Limark Picnic at, I believe it was Bethpage State Park. And I think it was at least one other event. So we'll be discussing some of those things. We'll also probably pick up some of the data of last week that we didn't get to. And I've got some comments on that. We particularly got into World Trade Center controversies as to what really took place. And we may discuss that a little bit in the later hours after the first hour and a half when we get into the deeper material. Not everyone is pleased by that. But what you could do if you...
Repeater, timeout. Repeater, timeout. Cancel.
By way of those recordings where you can go to that website, you can skip through the material that doesn't doesn't interest you, if you know what I mean. Some people do that. That particular website, by the way, Mike Perry claims that the 200,000 hits have occurred on that website. I'm reasonably sure there are a number of colleges where the electrical engineering professor will tell their students to listen to the TechNet or the recordings as a way of getting another exposure to the way the real world of wireless electronics is being conducted today and what people are interested in. And from my point of view, the only way a person really learns wireless techniques is to do it with your own hands, in your own backyard, in your own basement, with your ham radio license, and talk to your fellow radio amateurs who have a similar passion. You can learn the wireless art and science that way, I think, 2, 3, 4 times faster than you can in a college. I'm very disappointed in the way wireless techniques are taught in our colleges. I'm convinced it can be done better, but that's a strongly felt opinion. Now, a person signs into the technical net by giving John and Dick your call letters, your name, and the word yes, which means you do have a question or a comment for the net. You need not sign in just because you're listening. We used to do that in the beginning, and for 10 minutes we just had a long list of people signing in saying, I'm here. Well, after 29 years on a repeater that covers a tri-state area, we believe somebody is listening. That doesn't have to be proven anymore. So a typical sign-in would sound like this, N2 EO, Rich and Yes. Give me your call letters right now, K2RIW.
WS2N, Paul with a yes.
N2 Mike Bravo with a yes.
Okay, we got Paul and Barry. Lucky for them, I know them well enough that I know their name. They didn't have to say it. Most other people should give me their call letters in their name because I'm so darn forgetful. So far, we got Paul and Barry. The next set of call letters and names, go right ahead right now.
TD2CGL, Robert, yes.
Okay, I think I got Kilo Delta 2, Charlie, Gulf, Lima, Robert. Is that true, Robert?
Yes.
Okay, you're number 3 on the list. Anyone else? Give me your call letters and name and the word yes at this time.
N6ZP, John, yes.
November 6th, Zulu Papa, John. John, out of curiosity, are you coming in from the California area or you happen to be local? Back to you for a quick one on that one, John.
I am currently local. I'm in Belmore. Came back recently and to move back to help out an aging parent here. So I am permanently local for the time being.
Okay, that's a good place, John. In my youth, I spent some time in Belmore, South Shore of Long Island. Okay, one last call. Anyone else to sign into the TechNet? Give me your call letters and name right now. We have more than enough to continue, so we can always pick up people later. Paul? Paul is our space expert. He'll be giving us at around 9 o'clock or so, 9:15, a report on what NASA is doing. But tonight he's got a technical question. Glad to hear it. WS2N, the microwave voice of Ronkonkoma, I think it is, K2RIW.
Yes, that's correct. And they got a question about generators. Now that field day is coming up. You to go out and buy one of these generators. What kind of a guarantee would you have at not getting interference? You know, some of them look like they're very good. Some of them nowadays are very inexpensive. But I wonder if anybody actually bought a generator and said, oh my goodness, this was a mistake. It's causing interference on my HF brakes. I wonder if there's problems with that. One I was looking at has a couple of 120 outlets coming out of it. So, I could run the power supply through that. And so it does have 112 volt connection coming out. I don't know how many amperes on the specifications. I can't find the amperage on that one circuit, but I would guess you could probably take the 12 volts and go directly into an HF rig, if you have that capability. I do. My Kenwood 440 runs on 12 volts or goes through the Kenwood power supply. So that's either or. So that's the question, Dick. I wonder if anybody's had problems with interference from these things. You got to ground them or whatever. Back to you, Dick.
It turns out that right after Hurricane Gloria, I was one of the leaders on Long Island who were collecting names of people who wanted to have their own standby 4-kilowatt generator to be able to power the house, because after Hurricane Gloria, quite a number of people were without power for 2, 3, 4, 5 days, one person for I think like 10 days, and you live in your house without refrigeration, without electricity, without hot water, you're camping out in your own house. After a while, it really gets you down, and those people said, never again, I'm going to have a generator. So I collected names. I was working for Airborne Instruments Laboratory at the time, and the bottom line is with AIL and a few other people from other places, including Rimark, all joined in on it, and we bought a total of 500 motor generator sets at 4 kilowatts each. We put in quite a few percent of the generating power of the of the Shoreham nuclear station. We put that into people's backyards. Let me drop.
WV2U, Paul with a comment.
WV2U, we're going to get to you in a minute after I finish making my statement there, Paul. So these 500 generators that we purchased, let's see now, Earth Energy Systems, I think was the brand name. It was a multi-fuel generator that could run on liquid propane, natural gas, or gasoline, and had a rudimentary kind of an electronic starter built in, 12-volt output, as well as a pair of 110-volt output, a 220 output, or a pair of 110 with circuit breaker. Awful nice machine for, in this day, $525 was a lot of machine that we got because it was in bulk. Lots of people worried about the interference it would create, and to our knowledge, it had almost none. It turns out that a modern-day motor generator set, Paul, really is a alternator. In other words, the actual generator itself runs pretty quiet. The only thing that's capable of making noise is the ignition system of the motor. Nowadays, you usually use resistance wiring, and the amount of ignition noise you get out of those things is fairly small. Even if you did get some, fixing it by putting shielding wiring over the spark plug wiring would be pretty easy to get around with. On top of that, let me drop. The kind of impulse noise you get out of a generator is a very brief, low-duty cycle time kind of spiky noise. If you've got the right kind of a noise blanker in your receiver, the Drake, many of the Drake, Drake R4C had the world's best. But the Kenwood 840, 950, many of the Kenwood receivers have a real good noise blanker that when you turn it on, the impulse noise you're getting from a motor generator set, the impulse noise from the ignition system, even from a noisy automobile, and much of the ignition noise you get, much of the static noise you would get from a arcing pole pig transformer, high voltage insulator, essentially disappears. So I think you don't have to worry about noise, Paul. I think you just go out and shop for your particular motor generator set based on watts and size of gas tank and price and weight and ease of transport and whether or not it is a industrial commercial rated engine with a steel sleeve as opposed to a pure aluminum piston and aluminum sleeved engine, which is not quite as good. I mean, the quality of the engine, the quality of the generator, and other things like that I would judge on in price. And there's a darn many of them that have been shipped ever since Hurricane Gloria. So many different brand names you can get from Home Depot, among other places, and Walmart, that I think you don't have to worry about the ignition noise, Paul, because even if it was there, I believe it's rather easy to solve. That's one man's opinion, and I don't think you can build an ignition system that's so noisy these days that you and I couldn't fairly easily fix it. Now, maybe Paul's got some comments on this. Maybe he's got a good or bad experience with a motor generator set. Whiskey Victor 2 Uniform, K2RIW. Go ahead, Paul.
WGB would comment also.
Much, Dick. I just wanted to mention that the TRRL has posted on YouTube an evaluation of a group of contemporary generators, and they do cite a noise problem, but it's because they're now using inverters on the back end of them. So they're using alternators to generate voltage, and then they're using an inverter to generate a sine wave, and they're citing that there are some noise issues with that, but they have also some home brew chokes that they've used to going to suppress some of that noise. But it's all up on the YouTube review. And I think if you do just a YouTube search for ARRL, they'll pop up. But it was I ran into it because it was a
ARRL has run a comparison shopping set of information on motor generator sets. And it's interesting that some of them contain a solid-state inverter. I'm kind of amazed that they go that way. I guess they can eliminate some of the iron by doing that, as opposed to a real alternator-type 60-cycle generator. You should know, Paul, that I am guessing you are running on a battery. And the charger was running on the battery simultaneously. As the battery was running down during your speech, the hum you were transmitting was getting louder and louder, and your audio was getting lower and lower. So that particular combination for transmitting you're using right now, you might want to change it or look into it a little bit because of that heavy 120-cycle hum we were hearing on that last transmission. John, let's see, I bet you had a lot of experience with motor generator sets with all of your portable operations you've done. KC2WGB, K2RIW.
KC2WGB. Good evening, Dick. Yes, quite a few. The only thing I was going to recommend to Paul is you want to make sure you do ground the generator. Very important. And you might want to look into getting a GFI for it also. Some of the generators are coming with that built in, but it must be grounded for that to work. And that's really important when you're working on the field. KC2WGB, back to you, Dick.
Yeah, that is a good point. And how you do the grounding, there's a bit of controversy as to how you do grounding of a generator. But just in case, in a portable operation during a field day operation, there is the possibility that somebody's transmitter becomes improperly wired, a frayed cord or whatever, so that a hot bleed touches the chassis of the rig, and therefore that floating antenna that's up in the air and the rig itself could become 110 volts above ground, and by way of the third prong, the so-called green wire, the main middle prong that you've got that's on the plug that goes into the wall, that whole system, the so-called safety grounding, really should have a good an EIA standard ground at the generator site of your field day operation. If you do visit the Limock Field Day operation, which will be in existence in, I guess, about 2 weeks, they do it right. Just studying their operation would give you a lot of good information.
I think that's 1 week, Dick.
There you go. Thank you, Barry. 1 week. Okay, next week. I guess you're saying, yeah, that's right. The contest was this week. So it looks like Field Day is next week. We think, wait a minute. I thought Field Day is the last weekend of the month. Are you sure it's next week, Barry?
It's the week after the VHF contest, which is going on as we speak.
There we go. Okay, so visit them next week, and you'll see how it can be done correctly. So a good grounding for human safety reasons, I do recommend you do that, because...
Field day's the 23rd.
It's on the 23rd? How many weeks away is that?
The week after Father's Day. Hey, Nick, how you doing? WY2U.
WY2U, thank you, Alrighty. So it's not next week, according to them, Barry. Maybe it's not the week after the VHF con. We'll eventually find that out.
2 weeks, the 23rd and 24th.
Okay, 2 weeks away. So, alrighty. I think you've got most of the information you need on that one, Paul. As I say, I don't think you've got to worry about it. But by way of the ARRL rating, I think you'll get a lot more information. WS2N. K2RIW and TechNet, and also tell us, will there be a NASA report tonight?
Yes, the guy was very small. A NASA report, but we'll do that, of course, like you said, later. Thanks for the comments. especially on the ground, grounding situation. You know, without grounded right to the water pipe. That's where the generator would temporarily be anyway. And as far as the noise blanket, yeah, I got the Kenwood 440. That thing, when I used to have the shack in the basement near the oil burner, when that thing kicked on, as long as that noise blanket was on, I would never hear that, hear the oil burner. So I know that really works good. But no problem, man, with that. And then I'll search for the ARRL YouTube that Paul recommended. And I know QSC had a reviews on different generators, but I thought I'd ask. You know, they recommend, you know, of course they recommend the, they like the Honda, let me drop it. You know, I've been going to the Weimark field day recently, in the last couple of years, and now they got the Honda generators, and they're real nice, they're real quiet. But they're into the megabucks, you know, some of these cheaper ones are pretty good. I wouldn't go too cheap. But I see some nice ones around. I wouldn't go with the two-cycle ones because I find they're noisy, but I see reasonable price four-cycle engines. One I was looking at was only 70 dB. I looked it on the chart, and that's only about as loud as we talk. I don't know if that chart is right because they also said a dial tone is 80 dB. I'm not sure if that chart is that accurate, but that's what they say. So I wouldn't be too bad. But I was more interested in the interference problem. I was thinking about it originally, and let me drop it. They had a sale on these 45-watt solar panels. There's three panels, 15 watts each. You know, you'd have to buy an inverter and all. But that's what it is, you know, for like, I don't know, $180 or something. It's fine, but you'd have multiple solar panels. For years they used to take big car batteries, hook them up in the backyard, and run, you know, battery power. And, you know, you send it into QSC that way, you know. But thinking about going with the generator battery thing, it's just too much with all these batteries. But solar panel thing would be good. That looks like it's on the expensive side. And then what do you do with them afterwards, you know? At least the generator you can throw back into the garage and stuff. And what are you going to do with these big panels? Leave them out there and let them get weathered. So that's it. That's what I've been thinking about, Dick. But we'll try to make Lime on field day anyway. But no reason you can't have both. Back to you, Dick.
Quite good, Paul. Let us know what you decide on that generator, because there probably are other people out there going through a similar search that you're going through, and when you finally settle on one, gives you the mostest for the leases. We'd like to know about that. Next person in the list was Barry into Moonbound, and Barry just recently put up a 2-meter Yagi, which I think is 52 feet long, on top of his approximately 100-foot tower in his backyard, which I keep calling it a windjammer tower, but it's really not. Aero motor or something like that is a tower. So with that blowtorch on 2 meters, horizontally polarized for single sideband, I suspect there are times when he opens the band and closes the band for those guys, and he loans the band to them when he's not on the air. I'm exaggerating a little bit. N2 Moonbound, K2REW, by Barry.
Okay, actually that's 6 meters, not 2 meters, that antenna. And that's part of my comment tonight. We are, of course, having a VHF contest as we speak. I think it goes on until pretty late tonight, actually. And I just want to comment that 6 meters, for some reason, is really putting on a show tonight. I don't know why. It's just unusually good. I work stations as far away as Hawaii and a lot of them along the coast, Oregon, California, and the Midwest. I mean, the band's really doing good today. Don't know why. I mean, it's nice, but very unusual. And that's part of my comment. The other comment was, I guess a lot of people here know Rich N2EO, who had an operation on his foot this morning. He will be coming home probably Monday, maybe as late as Tuesday, but it looks like it's Monday now. And they didn't hurt him too bad. He's actually going to be in pretty good shape. So that's my report for the evening. Back to Net Control and to Mike Bravo.
Now, those who have ever used 6-meter single sideband and rapidly are happy to call it the magic band, because 6 meters has a little bit of everything. I don't think it's got D layer absorption, but it's got E and sporadic E and F1 and F2 and trans-equatorial and field-aligned anomaly and meteor scatter and moon bounce and aurora and satellite. It's got a little bit of everything. On top of that, every year, late May, early in June, the band has higher than normal propagating characteristics, and then once again, I think early in December, there's another little peak. So the combination of this is the best time of year, the combination of, for all we know, we've had some minor flares out of the sun that have squirted some more of the solar mass expulsion or ejection material at us, which ionizes the atmosphere a little bit more. So the sun may have contributed, the time of year is doing it, and you've got one hell of an antenna with a 52-foot long boom. And if I know, you're running a rather clean, reasonably high-powered single sideband signal. From your point of view right now, try to make a guess, Barry. You're getting this ridiculous amount of DX on 6 meters. We are talking to guys in Hawaii, which is probably, let me drop this, from Far Rockaway, Long Island to Hawaii, I'm guessing it takes 3 hops of sporadic E or whatever to get there. I think it's at least 3 hops, maybe even 4. And so make a guess. How much of this great DX you're now experiencing is the antenna, and how much of it is Mother Nature? Do you think you would have worked Hawaii if you had a hip squeak signal and a small little antenna and didn't have 100 feet tower? N2 moon bounce. Make some guesses on that one, Barry. K2RIW.
Okay, that's an easy guess, actually. Yes, I would have. Actually, the signals are really loud. I used to have a 5-element, in fact, I still own it, 5-element Kush craft. I am absolutely positive I could have done it with the Kush craft. That's how good signals are. They're very, very loud today. And what was the other problem? I'm not running high power at the moment. I'm working on a kilowatt, but I'm only running 100 watts tonight, and that's all I have been running for quite some time. So, yeah, conditions just happen to be unusually good tonight.
Make me a guess, Barry. Is Hawaii to you, Great Circle Path, approximately 5,000 miles? And let me think now. I think you can only get about 1,300 miles or so per hop. I'm beginning to think that might have to be 4 hops. Am I in the right ballpark to say Hawaii from you, Great Circle Path, close to 5,000 miles? Go ahead, Barry.
I would say so. I have to check the guy I work. I could see it on QRZ. If I look it up, it's about 5.5, I think. I think about 5,500 miles. It's a pretty good haul.
For a VHF frequency, that's really down the road a piece. when I first started operating on 10 gigahertz, although not too many months downrange, I did manage to talk to a guy 380 miles away in Cape Hatteras, North Carolina, from my home QTH, and I was running 200 milliwatts solid-state transmitter. And I'm talking to him on sideband, and because of some help from Mother Nature, 380 miles away, 200 milliwatts, that's real QRP, from my point of view, I started calculating how many wavelengths. A wavelength on 10,000 megacycles is 1 inch, 3 centimeters, 1 inch. 1 inch is the wavelength, and you calculate how many zillions of wavelengths there are between here and Cape Hatteras. You say to yourself, how in the world does a signal go that far without getting tired? And if you made a similar calculation in your case, 5,500 miles on 6 meters, a lot of wavelengths in there. And the air isn't necessarily required. I mean, if it was a free space path, if there was a satellite out there over Hawaii and you had a free space path to it, and there's nothing out there in that free space but vacuum, how does that signal get through that vacuum? Well, we can get in all kinds of philosophy as to how that works, and it's not easy to understand. There's a lot more mystery to it after all these years. Radio's great stuff. Next person on the list was Robert, Kilo Delta 2, Charlie Golf Lima. What would you like to talk about tonight, Bob? K2RAW. My name is Dick.
Okay. Kilo Delta 2, Charlie Golf Lima. I've been practicing the extra class exam here for a while. I'm getting pretty good at it. Most of it seems to be memorization after you do it 20 or 30 times. But there always seems to be some testy questions right around 20, 21, 2, 3, 4, somewhere in the low 20s, which require calculations. And you either know the formula or you don't. And this is where I'm getting into some trouble. So I can give you an example. What is the power factor of an RL circuit having a 60-degree phase angle between the voltage and the current? How do you go about doing that? Over.
Yeah, it turns out that in order to keep Con Ed and Long Island Power Authority, in order to keep New Jersey Power and Light, in order to keep those people happy, particularly if you're a large, major factory, using a whole lot of power, they want you to be a pure resistive load. A pure resistor has 0 degrees of phase shift between the current and the voltage. At the instant, if you were looking at a dual trace oscilloscope, and your upper trace is looking at the voltage versus time being applied to your circuit, and the lower trace is looking at current versus time, and you look at these two waveforms, the two waveforms would look like they could lay exactly on top of each other once you set the gains correctly. In other words, left and right shift on the dual trace oscilloscope, there would be zero phase shift if you've got a pure resistive load. That's the most desirable. You're about to find out why anything else is undesirable. Let me drop. Now I'm going to go to the next extreme. And this is one of the puzzles that I've often given electrical engineers. And even good RF engineers have a lot of trouble with this one, Bob. So I know I'm going to be telling you things beyond what you asked, but maybe it'll help. One of the puzzles I give people is that I got a 50-ohm coaxial cable. I got ideal instrumentation on the input end of it. So I can measure the standing wave ratio, what's going on with that cable. At the output end of the cable, I put an extremely high quality capacitor. I carefully adjust that capacitor at the operating frequency. Let's assume I'm using 100 megacycles. I carefully adjust the size of that capacitor so it is a 50-ohm reactance. So the capacitor has got the right number of picofarads, so it is a 50-ohm load. So I got a 50-ohm cable, and I got a 50-ohm capacitor at the far end, and I asked them, what is the standing wave ratio for that particular circuit? About 70% of the reasonably smart engineers will say, you've got a 50-ohm load, a 50-ohm cable, that's a 1-to-1 standing wave ratio. I then start asking them further questions. Okay, how hot is the capacitor getting? It's an ideal capacitor. It has very little equivalent series resistance. And you could buy a capacitor that's good enough to do this. I ask them, how hot is the capacitor getting? And I can eventually get them to admit that you cannot continuously put power into a capacitor. It is not an energy-absorbing device in a continuous manner. Yes, it'll absorb energy on the first half of the cycle, and it'll give it back to you on the second half of the cycle, but in the big picture, it will not absorb energy. So then I start asking them questions. Okay, you think you're putting 100 watts down that cable, you've measured the voltage, you've measured the current, and the capacitor is not absorbing any of the power. Where's it going? With conservation of energy. The bottom line is that a pure reactance at the end of a transmission line absorbs no power, reflects every bit of it. The standing wave ratio is infinity. You put 100 watts down that cable, 100 watts.
Repeater, timeout, cancel.
You put 100 watts transmitted down that cable, exactly 100 watts will reflect back to you. You got a good, if you had a pure 50-ohm transmitter. In this particular case, you better have one because you've got a really high VISWA. If you had a pure 50-ohm transmitter, and most of them are not, that's another whole issue, you would see your bird watt meter telling you the truth, would see 100 watts going forward and 100 watts coming back. You then do that same test with the oscilloscope. You would find out that right at that capacitor, you got that beautiful voltage waveform on the upper trace of your dual trace scope, you got the beautiful current waveform on the lower trace, and you would see they are shifted 90 degrees, quarter wavelength, with the current waveform shifted ahead. It would be leading in current by 90 degrees. The bottom line is that when you've got 90 degrees of phase shift, which means it's a pure capacitor that will be 90 degrees leading phase shift, or a pure inductor, that would be 90 degrees of lagging phase shift. When you've got 90 degrees of phase shift, you absorb no power. Yet voltage is going down that line, current is down that line. If that was a Con Ed transmission line, they'd be heating up their wires, current would be flowing, you'd be absorbing no power. The watt-hour meter on the outside of your house would not turn. So you're burning up their lines, you're using their resources, and they can't collect any money for it, and they get mad at you. So now you can see that phase shift explains why power factor exists. If I take the cosine of 60 degrees, I then know what the power factor is. That's the amount of power that you're not absorbing, if you know what I mean. So phase shift is where it's at. Once they told you the phase shift, you can calculate the power factor. You now know why it's undesirable for normal power circuits like a transmission line going to an antenna. If it's part of a resonating circuit of your free-running oscillator for your VFO, that
repeater, timeout, repeater, timeout, cancel.
In the case of a resonating circuit, the phase shift we're talking about could be very desirable. There's a lot more to the story, as you can tell, but maybe this helps a little bit, Robert, and you're allowed to ask more questions on the subject because it's a good one. KD2, CGL, K2RIW in the TechNet.
Very good. Yeah, right at the end. Cosine of 60. Bam. 0.5. You got it. Of course, there are other questions similar to that. There's usually a questionnaire with X and Y coordinates, and they'll tell you what's the angle and how many ohms. I think you're familiar with these questions. They're always in the low 20s. The resonant frequency, that's pretty straightforward. You just plug the numbers right in. So, yeah, actually answered, I'd say, two or three questions there in the same shot. Very good. Thank you.
The one other thing that's not made clear, as it should be, in my opinion, with our electrical engineering courses and some of the sections of the question pool, is that all real circuits have some amount of resistance and some amount of reactance, whether it be capacitive or inductive. The capacitive or inductive reactance portion, in general, operates at exactly 90 degrees away from the resistive component. So once you understand how to do a little bit of trigonometry of right triangles, and if you now can draw a right triangle where one of the legs is the resistive component in ohms, the other leg is the reactive component in ohms, and you set up this right triangle, you know what the length of leg number one is, you know what the length of leg number two is, you connect those tips together, that's the hypotenuse of the triangle, that triangle gives you a hell of a lot of information. The length of that hypotenuse is the total impedance. You know that if you want to calculate with trigonometry the length of a hypotenuse, it's the square root of the sum of the squares. That means that if you take the square root of the resistive component squared plus the capacitive component squared, add them together, put them inside that square root sign, now you know the length of the hypotenuse, that is the total impedance. But if you want to know the reactive component and the resistive component, it's the two legs. And by either sine or cosine, you can figure out which angle is in there. That happens to be the phase angle. So once you start drawing that that right triangle, some of this will become a little bit more clear. It's not just pure memorization. Let me drop one of the points. After 40 years of experience of radio and wireless and whatever, because I've got the passion for it and I've been working at it all these years, there are people who think I know something. That's relative. However, I passed my novice exam, general exam, way back in the 50s by pure memorization. Took out the license manual. I think it was an ARRL publication in those days. And I was memorizing what is a joule, a watt, and a kilobert, and an ohm, and a volt, and an ampere. I was just memorizing all those equations. And in those days, we had to draw the diagrams of a transmitter and a receiver in order to pass the test for the general in front of an FCC examiner at the 748 Federal Building, 641 Washington Street, Manhattan, New York. That's where we all had to go in those days. And we had to get in front of, I can't forget that guy's name with the cigar, but he was famous. Anyhow.
Finkelman.
Mr. Finkelman. And I bet your Barry has been before him a number of times. A tough guy. I mean, he was the equivalent of Morgan Freeman in and you know, as a drill sergeant, if you know what I mean. Anyhow, pure memorization isn't bad from my point of view, as long as you follow through later on. Eventually, as I started talking to other ham radio operators, doing the stuff, building circuits, building antennas, setting up feed lines and whatever, I slowly found out what these things mean and why those words are valuable. Even though I started off with pure memorization, hadn't the vaguest idea what they stood for. So there, you get mixed opinions on that as to the right way to learn it. Passing the test is good, and the real learning, the test is supposed to tell you, it's supposed to tell the FCC that this guy's got enough enthusiasm, he's valid enough to give him a license, and once he starts talking to people on the air, if he sticks with it, he's going to learn a whole lot, don't worry about it. I think it's their philosophy, if you know what I mean. So good luck with that, Robert, and come back with more questions in the future. Next guy on the list was John, November 6th.
Repeater, timeout, cancel.
As you can see, this guy, Dick Nadel, is K2RIW, is he's long-winded. I keep timing the machine out. Every minute or so, if you talk long enough, every minute we're supposed to give an interruption and wait for the three beeps. N6 Zulu Papa, go ahead, John, K2RIW.
Yes, Dick. I had a question on fractal antennas and whether or not anyone has worked out any kind of decent formulas that would be fairly easy to understand to work out a HF antenna for, a fractal antenna for HF spectrum. And also, do you think it would be possible to make a fractal antenna out of a foil-faced foam board that could be etched like a circuit board and then used as like a stealth antenna within a house? That's basically my question for the night. Thank you. N6ZP.
Boy, John, you came to the right place. Let me think now. What year was it? 2005, approximately. I'm heavily involved in an antenna development program for a Long Island company. And the Fractal Antenna Company in Boston, can't think of his name right now, and call it, he's a ham radio operator, awful nice guy. We visited him, sat down with him, looked at his whole product line, and we did quite a bit of study of fractal antennas used at UHF frequencies. We were using it at 900 megacycles. What can a fractal buy for you? Well, in the process, I found out an awful lot about what a fractal is. I managed to now rearrange that data and rearrange it so that it makes sense with what I know about antennas. I'm going to tell you what I know. Fractal antennas are fairly nice, but they do not contain magic, in my opinion. The people who are new converts to fractal would lead you to believe that there's some kind of hidden magic in there. Not very much of it, with a couple of exceptions. And here's the basic, here's where the rubber meets the road with reference to an antenna. Let me drop. The most basic of all antennas is a dipole. And if I'm operating on, say, for instance, the 80-meter band, where ordinarily a dipole at a reasonable altitude made out of 14-gauge household wire is going to be in the vicinity of 132 feet long. Physical length will be 132 feet. It'll come very close to resonance at, let me pick a number, roughly 3.6 megacycles. And it'll have reasonable Q. In other words, the standing wave ratio will start going up quite a bit higher as you go away from that frequency. You'll probably hit numbers like 3-to-1 standing wave ratio at the end of the band. I don't know the exact number, but these are ballparks. Now, you could, if you want to, decide that my property is not long enough. I can't string up 132 feet of wire. Can I make it physically smaller? Absolutely. There's a zillion ways you can squeeze that 132 feet of sample antenna, this dipole on 80 meters. I could squeeze it down to 100 feet, 80 feet, 60 feet, 60 feet, 40 feet, 30 feet, 20 feet. I can make it smaller and smaller. I can zigzag the wire. I can put loading coils at the bottom. I can put top hat capacitors at the top. I can try all kinds of combinations of these. There's zillions of ways I can squeeze the antenna very small and still keep it resonant. And if I've now got a large enough amount of dynamic range to my antenna tuner, and if I got the antenna tuner located close enough to the antenna or low enough feed line, like maybe open wire line, by way of the antenna tuner, in theory, without doing the loading coils and everything else, I could probably make the antenna 22 feet long with a real wide range antenna tuner, bring it back into resonance, and get 95% efficiency out of that shrunk down antenna. I can do all that if I'm smart enough, but there's a catch. Let me drop. I know you've heard about it already, John. Mother Nature's got a couple of tricks up her sleeve. The main trick she's got, I call it conservation of misery. You can squeeze that antenna down as much as you want, but you're going to pay a couple of prices for it. Number one, the Q is going to go sky high. In other words, instead of the antenna giving you a 1-to-1 standing wave ratio in the middle of the band where you tune it, and at the end of the 80-meter band, it's going to go to a 2 or 3-to-1 standing wave ratio. When you physically squeeze the antenna down, by whatever means, fractal is one of those means, by whatever means you squeeze it down, if you didn't devote the real estate, now that 132 feet is the full real estate of that dipole antenna, and you can use less and less real estate if you're smart enough, but the price you pay is that now when you plot standing wave ratio versus frequency, that bathtub-shaped curve starts looking like an upside-down needle. In other words, if you move 50 kc up the band, all of a sudden the antenna goes up to an extremely high standing wave ratio. It becomes a very narrow band antenna from a standing wave ratio point of view. And by the way, it'll confuse the daylights out of you. How can an antenna that's 25 feet long have the exact same gain, which means effective capture area, of that 132-foot long piece of wire? That's a tough one. Take my word for it, you're going to get the exact same gain. Well, never more than a half a dB change in gain as you start going to the infinitesimal dipole. You only lose half a dB, and it's not efficiency loss. It's a slight shift in the pattern. The figure eight pattern becomes a little bit fatter. So fractal is one of the ways you can squeeze it down. Whenever you do anything to not use full real estate on the antenna, you will pay the price. Bandwidth is the first price you're going to pay. Let me drop. The second price you're going to pay is that since the bandwidth went down, that's a fancy way of saying the Q went up. The word Q has got about 5 meanings to it. One of the meanings of Q is center frequency divided by bandwidth. That's one of the definitions of Q. And since the Q is going very small and you're dividing it into the center frequency, the number you come up with, the Q, becomes very large. Q is also defined as the voltage rise at resonance. It's also defined as the current rise at resonance. It's also defined as the energy stored per cycle versus the energy dissipated per cycle. It's a bunch of definitions. You squeeze that antenna down. The voltage at the tips is going to go sky high. The current somewhere in there is going to go sky high. If you're smart enough to use the right kind of materials, fat enough piece of wire so the current doesn't bother you, high enough quality capacitors so that the current doesn't bother you, rounded off tips so that the arcing over and corona doesn't bother you, if you use enough smart, you can do this. And even if the antenna's got extremely high Q, you're a guy who can use the right kind of a computer program that readjusts the tuning and loading control, so to speak, when you go to a new frequency, and the fact that it's got very narrow bandwidth doesn't bother you because you retune it every time you go to the new frequency. You can see the pros and cons. If you're willing to devote the resources, I can squeeze that antenna down as small as you want, and I can get nearly full performance out of it. You say those words on a 20-meter band on a Saturday afternoon, and a hell of a lot of people will say, "What are you smoking? You're crazy." And then you start referring them to the chapter out of the Bible, which is the antenna book by, the book called Antennas by Krauss, W-H-A-K, a Bible of a book on the subject of antennas, 1950 McGraw-Hill. You look at the chapter on the infinitesimal dipole. You will eventually come to the conclusions that I've just given you. N6 Zulu Papa. There's a lot more to the story, but you're getting the beginning of it, John. K2RIW in the TechNet.
What about capture area, Dick? W2TDC.
Capture area is fully there. If the gain is there, the capture area is there, because gain is a constant times area. That squeezed down little bitty antenna, your eye does not see the area. The radio wave, when the circuit is resonant, it sees that area. Of course, that sounds crazy. I can give you a bunch of experiments where you can, in your backyard, you can confirm that. It is way beyond common sense. I'm going to admit that, GTT. Back to you, John. N6, Zulu Papa, K2RIW on the TechNet.
Because you've coupled the energy one way or the other, in or out of the antenna. I get it. W2TTT.
Yeah, the magic of resonance is it picks up the area. That 80-meter dipole that I just described, let me drop it. This is one step beyond what John asked for. The 80-meter dipole, 132 feet long, with a gain of 2.14 dB over isotropic. That's what a dipole's got at a reasonable altitude. You study what that means. That antenna really has an effective capture area of 8,500 square feet. And I'm not kidding. If your eye operated at 80 meters, and you stand off a mile away, and you look down the throat of that antenna, that 80-meter dipole, you will see a great big black oval in space with the dipole in the middle of that oval, and the oval will have 8,500 square feet of area. For every 80-meter signal with a horizontal polarization arriving at a thin antenna, you will suck up 8,500 square feet of it. It gets onto that wire, it goes down the feed line, and moves the S-meter on your receiver. That's the real effective capture area of that antenna. You squeeze it down to the infinitesimal size and re-resonate it in a lossless manner, you will have within half a dB, you will have that exact same 8,000 square feet of area. Your eye will see that area, even though the wire inside of that oval, so to speak, is now getting very small. That's the magic of resonance. You set up that dipole at the exact same altitude as the power lines across the street, and you say to yourself, gee, those power lines are directly northeast of me. I want to talk to the guys in Europe, and those damn power lines are in the way, and they're going to give me a shadow, a great big blockage. Because those power lines are not resonant, their physical area of a couple of square feet of the actual wire itself is going to cast a shadow on your antenna of 8,500 square feet. That's very little shadow. In other words, those wires of the power line company right across the street from you at the exact same altitude looks like it should be one hell of a blockage. If it is not resonant, it is 95% transparent.
What methods do you prefer to make that dipole red?
Repeater, timeout. Repeater, timeout. Cancel.
Okay. Oh, you can re-resonate the dipole by a zillion different techniques as you shrink it down. Loading coils at the bottom, zigzagging of the wire, top cap capacitors, and a real wide range antenna tuner right at the antenna. Or a real wide antenna tuner through a very low loss feed line like open wire line. And the antenna tuner's in the shack. If you've got a wide enough tuning range on your antenna tuner, if you have a low enough feed line like open wire line, you can resonate anything in the world. The real magic of transmitting a radio signal, your radiating system will resonate first, then it can radiate. That's the magic of resonance. You will not transmit per se, with some rare exceptions. A non-resonant antenna can only give you good efficiency if it's got a zillion wavelengths, like a beverage or a rhombic antenna. But if it is a standing wave structure antenna, that's what every dipole is, standing wave structure. That's a fancy way of saying that the signal going down that feed line that hits the antenna, you want to believe that the signal gets onto the antenna and just jumps into space. Good theory. Naive as all hell. No way. That signal bounces back and forth on that wire roughly 20 times before it goes into space. You could say 5% of it leaves on each bounce. What you and I call resonance is to make sure that those 20 bounces stay in step with each other. It's very similar to pushing a child on a swing. You have to push at the right time compared to the resonance of that person on the swing, the length of the pendulum, if you know what I mean, and very rapidly you build up a very large deflection. You have to build up a very large voltage bouncing back and forth. Call it current, call it charge, bouncing back and forth on that dipole. And if 20 bounces, it gets radiated into space. Radiation is hard. You have to kick that signal in the tail.
Repeater, timeout, cancel.
It turns out radiating a radio signal is difficult. You have to kick that signal in the tail 20 times in a row before it finally leaves. It's one way of looking at it. So the radiating structure consists of the antenna tuner if you're using it, the feed line, the antenna tuner in the shack if you're using it, the tank circuit of the final of the transmitter. That total radiating system, you will resonate it, then it can radiate. And so fractals is one of the ways you can squeeze it down, loading coils, zigzag, top hat capacitors, and a very wide range antenna tuner is another way you can do it. Pays you money, it takes your choice. They all work, but from my point of view, there is no hidden magic in fractal, per se. There are some very nice characteristic the fractal has. Its major strength, from my point of view, is that if you set up a fractal just right, it takes up a slightly smaller amount of real estate. That's the good news. It has a higher Q in doing that. If you, no matter how you squeeze down the real estate, the Q will increase. The bandwidth will go down. But properly setting up a fractal, you can make the antenna structure resonate on 2, 3, 4 frequencies at once. That's a real advantage. You could also do it by putting a couple of parallel wires out there. A fan dipole also does it. The fractal looks exotic, and everyone believes it's got some extra magic. I don't think so. But that's an opinion. Talk to some other people before you settle on what you believe is the truth. I've given you a bunch of opinions, John. I don't guarantee that every one of them is accurate.
Can you give us an example of a fractal antenna? I'm not sure what they look like.
Often they look like a step and repeat diagram. There are kinds of fractals that look like a whole bunch of triangles of sheet metal packed in real tight with each other. Some of them look like that. Some of them look like squares, step and repeat squares packed in real tight. If you simply Google the word fractal and Google fractal in Wikipedia, you're going to get a zillion examples, Barry. As I say, it's just another way of zigzagging the sheet metal, so to speak. They do have the magic that you can make multiple resonances. But does it have extra gain for the size? Absolutely not. When it comes to a simple dipole-like antenna, no matter how you set it up with a fractal, it's not going to suddenly have super gain. Now, if you start setting up fractals so that you got to get a bunch of fractals as the driven element, another bunch of fractals as the first director, another bunch as the second director, if I'm now creating a Yagi-like structure out of fractals, yes, I can give you a lot more gain. And I can give you a little bit less size of the Yagi by doing that. It's one of the squeezing down techniques. That's what fractal really can do for you. Multiple resonance, squeeze down in size. But once again, if you don't pay the piper, so to speak, if you haven't devoted the real estate, you will get a decrease in bandwidth and an increase in voltage and an increase in current somewhere in the system. N6, Zulu Papa, KQLIW on TechNet. You got it, John.
Okay, first thing I want to thank you for explaining Q to me after all these years. I really understood what that meant. And then I got to have you into understanding it. And then also, do you know if any analysis programs that will plot out a fractal antenna for me? I really don't know how to put the input on something like that.
John, I'm guessing you're using a handy talkie antenna. You were 80% noise on that particular transmission, and you were moving in such a way that you were going into phase. I got the message, don't worry. But I'm letting you know that when you move around a handy talkie so you get the strongest possible signal on reception, it's not necessarily the strongest signal for transmission because the frequencies are different. There's a different number of wavelengths. So those peaks and valleys and nulls that are in the room with you are a slightly different location for peaks and valleys for reception versus transmission because of the 600 kc of offset. So you unfortunately moved to a place where your transmission was very noisy into the repeater, but we got the message. And that is, are there computer programs that will give you fractal design? Absolutely. Where are they? What's their name? I don't know. Guarantee, though, because it's a subject that's been around since, it's been popular for at least 20 years to my knowledge, maybe 30 or 40. Mandelblot plots are the beginning of these things. It's often a mathematical equation which has got a kind of a feedback to it that allows you to derive these things. I'm reasonably sure you're going to find a lot of references on fractal and fractal design if you Google those words. And so bear in mind ahead of time that from my point of view, they are handy, they're beautiful looking, they're exotic, they allow you to shrink down an antenna, but they do not have any magic with reference to gain. Gain comes from real estate. Gain comes from the signal bouncing back and forth on the antenna 20 times. That's how you radiate a signal. And what directivity pattern you get out of an antenna is strictly a function of the number of wavelengths of the antenna. And I'm going to give you one formula, a rule of thumb formula on this one. Let me drop. I'll admit that the formula I'm about to give you is primarily applied to VHF and UHF antennas, but it works on HF antennas. you tell me how many wavelengths wide is the aperture that's emitting the signal from your antenna. You tell me how many wavelengths wide it is. Take that number and divide it into 70. That is the half-power beamwidth of the antenna.